you reap what you sow. I think death is the best thing for you. It will not solve anything. It will not make us feel better. We will be relieved that his breath has been taken away from them.
Sisters with gunshot wounds in their head.
And look him in the eye. It's a stare you'll never forget. Witness after witness has to come before him in a courtroom.
The Jones is going to be taken care of forever, and he'll never do harm to nobody else. Governor Ryan, you will be remembered by the people more if you do this thing right.
I never planned on being involved, frankly, in the debate over capital punishment or even in examining the system. Capital punishment, to me, was something that I thought of only in the abstract. It was there. I was a pharmacist. I wasn't a lawyer. And I didn't pay much attention to the criminal justice system or to the death penalty. I'm from Kankakee. It's 60 miles south of here. But it's 1,000 miles difference in style and in philosophy. We didn't think much about capital punishment in Kankakee. But when something came up or there was a terrible crime committed, we wanted the police to find the bad guy, lock him up, and if the crime was bad enough, to get the chair for what he did. That was even all the better. We were happier if that happened. But it was still kind of in the abstract, and it was left up to those people that did their job. In 1977, I voted to reinstate the death penalty in Illinois. I vividly remember an opponent of capital punishment who challenged those of us who voted to put capital punishment back on the book. I was standing on the floor of the House, and I had punched my green button. And somebody on the other side stood up and said, "How many of you that are voting green would be willing to throw the switch in the electric chair?" More than 20 years later, I was busy campaigning for governor. And that's when Larry Marshall and David Protest and their students began the remarkable effort to uncover the truth of the case of Anthony Porter.
Over the past several years, their appearances outside prison walls have had a disconcerting regularity. Men condemned by Illinois as convicted murderers have been shown to be not guilty and been set free.
As a college senior, I had the opportunity to take David Protest's investigative journalism class. And I don't know why I took the class. I took it because it sounded fun. And I ended up working on the case of Anthony Porter. Anthony had come within 50 hours of execution, exactly a week before we started class. And he received a stay at the last minute, but he didn't receive a stay because anyone thought he was innocent. He received a stay because his IQ had been tested at 51, and there were questions about whether he was competent to be executed. We went and we reenacted the crime, and we found out that the eyewitness who said he had seen Anthony Porter committing the crime couldn't have seen it at all. Then the eyewitness recanted. Then we tracked down the ex-wife of the person we thought was the real killer, and she told us on video that she had been there when her husband committed the crime. And a week later, her husband confessed to private investigator Paul Cialino on video, and Anthony was released on the state's motion 2 days later. And I can't really describe. I had no idea that the justice system worked like that before I started to take. I just didn't know.
This was the third person released by the journalism students at Northwestern. And, of course, it doesn't say much for our legal system. When people spend 16 years on death row for a crime they don't commit or didn't commit, and that ultimately comes to light not because of the police or the prosecution or the defense lawyers or the judicial system, but because a journalism class at Northwestern took it on as a class project to see whether or not these people were guilty or not. You know, if those students had taken chemistry that semester, these folk would have been executed.
Thank you. When Governor Ryan first took office, we had no reason to believe that he was particularly sensitive or concerned about the issue. Quite to the contrary, we knew that throughout his legislative career, he had been a strong advocate of the death penalty. What we didn't know is that when the Chicago Tribune ran its series on problems with the death penalty and wrongful convictions, he read it and he paid attention to facts.
After Anthony Porter was set free, you had a lot of sort of commentary, and it just seemed natural that maybe we need to provide the information. We looked at every death penalty case in Illinois and just sort of find out what they're made of, and, you know, what kind of witnesses, who are the lawyers, you know, what are their records, and it would inform the debate. And it would sort of really sort of tell you whether, are these problems isolated or are they just run through the system?
These journalists went into waters that had never been swum in before. They went and studied hundreds of cases.
You'd finish a case and you go, you know, holy moly, you know, here's
how did this
one.
Happen?
You know, why is it that there's this, you know, 60-year-old probate lawyer doing a case, and the day his partner is out supposedly investigating, he walks in and pleads the guy guilty with no deal at all. You know, and doesn't even know what the rules are. You know, why is there a guy who's been suspended all these times, you know, a judge is putting him on a case right after he gets off a suspension? Why is a guy just out of law school getting a case? Everybody thought that you get the good lawyers when you're on trial for your life.
All these cases suddenly stack up, and you go, wait a minute, this isn't just an individual, it's a system. It's a systemic problem that allows, it's almost sieve-like that these different things slip through.
We now had 13 death row inmates exonerated. That means that we had more people exonerated from death row than the 12 we executed out of 25. It's like flipping a coin. Heads or tails, live or die. Can you believe that?
All of the people who had been sentenced to death had been sentenced under a system that was not trustworthy, that was not fair. I mean, the analogy that we were using was, imagine there had been a whole string of crashes involving a certain airplane, and you really couldn't figure out why it was happening. You knew there was a real problem with the airplane, but you couldn't detect it. So what would you do? Well, you would take that airplane out of commission. You would stop using it. And that's what we were arguing about the death penalty situation, that if the system was broken, you need to take it out of commission.
Larry Marshall called me and he said, we're going to start this wrongful conviction project. We think it's a effective way to deal with the death penalty. And I said, oh, come on, Larry. I said, we both know that that's not what's wrong with the death penalty. Now, I was wrong on two scores. There were many more innocence cases than I recognized even then when I'd been representing Hernandez for a while. That's number one. Number two, Larry's answer to me then is correct today. He said, that may be true, but even people who believe in the death penalty don't believe in executing innocent people, even one, let alone the more than 100 that have been ready for sacrifice in this country in the years after Furman.
American society is profoundly conflicted about the death penalty. We are a society, on the one hand, which believes in freedom, believes in equality, believes in freedom of opportunity, that whole set of what is sometimes called the American ideal. On the other hand, America is racist, sexist, classist. It has a history of oppression as bad as countries we regard as totalitarian. American policy with regard to the death penalty is not a stasis. It's the result of a tension between them as want it desperately and them as hate it.
The Supreme Court began hearing arguments today on the abolition of the death penalty, the first arguments of that kind ever presented to the court. Its opponents of the death penalty said it is a cruel and unusual punishment, and most often imposed on poor people and minorities.
Capital punishment was simply legal lynching throughout the South, throughout this entire period.
You have a death row, you know, with all these people on it, overwhelmingly minority, disproportionately minority, overwhelmingly poor. You see certain patterns. Folk didn't have quality counsel.
Very often it was simply calls from the community, from the clergy, from the head of the NAA chapter. You know, we've got a case. Help us. This guy's got no lawyer. Nobody to defend him.
I was hired at LDF as a death penalty lawyer because the push was on, you know, to see if we could do something across the country about this freakish imposition of the death penalty.
While I was in the death house, I spent a lot of time thinking about issues of life and death and thinking about the society I had come out of and or I was still part of or they was trying to eliminate me from.
This is the sequence he will follow when he dies. He will first be taken to the small suite of cells next to the electric chair. On the morning of his execution, he will leave his cell with guards and a chaplain. Then follows a curious attempt at humanity. The prisoner is taken along a specially constructed hallway. Nothing separates him from the outside world except an overhead grating. Guards, chaplain, and prisoner traditionally pause for a moment so the condemned man can take a last look at the sky and perhaps see one of the pigeons that often rest there. Donald Schnebel was convicted in 1965 of strangling and then shooting a woman. As he awaits the outcome of his legal appeals, he studies trigonometry and navigation, still hoping that one day he will be outside running a shrimp boat.
If you have hope, you hope. You don't have hope, you hope there's some hope anyway. Don't try to think of it.
Well, we had heard through rumors and grapevine and et cetera, that in all likelihood it would be turned over, right? But we still did not know. We were all hoping. And
I never thought about him last meal. I think I did think of what it would be like to go down that last mile. But those thoughts I kind of made or helped to escape. I escaped those thoughts. It's like I denied I was on death row. It just couldn't happen to me. I didn't believe that would happen to me.
Only in cases where the defendant was a member of a racial minority group, socially disadvantaged, a pariah, an outsider, was the death penalty actually used. And we began to put two and two together. Maybe that's what unusual means.
This statutory scheme that gives unbridled discretion to the jury without any guidelines or standards at all makes the death penalty too arbitrary and wanton and freakish in its imposition. Therefore, that is cruel and unusual punishment. That's what they say.
The Supreme Court, at long last, has delivered an opinion on capital punishment. After years of arguing about the legality of the death penalty, the United States joins the ranks of those countries where it is illegal. This will have an immediate effect on the lives of 600 men and women who have been awaiting execution in 31 states.
Then when Furman was decided, I never will forget it, we were ecstatic in the office, jumping around. And so we finally decided somebody has to tell the inmates in Georgia. We go to the state prison. We walk into a room. There is every person in death row sitting around in a semicircle. And the guard leaves and closes the door. I said, he's not happy with us. She said, no. And all the guys are sitting there. And so I looked at Lynn, and she looked at me. I said, you know, Lynn, I said, I'm glad we're bringing good news. I'm glad we're bringing good news. We had a good conversation with the folk on death row. You know, they want to know whether they could be re-sentenced to death, and I told them no, it would have to be, the most they could get would be life in prison. I mean, we just went through the whole thing.
It wasn't a loud excitement, it was just kind of a quiet excitement. I kept stunned and couldn't believe it, but it was a hope that just materialized.
I think that it was in reading the Furman decision that I was able to see that men had sincere concern for the lives of people such as I who had been on death row. Justice Marshall in particular felt that it was important that if a decision was made regarding the death penalty, that it should be a decision that would be free from error. And I took a little time to try to understand what this man meant.
We were honest about our history in Furman. And one of the great contributions that Justice Marshall made to the court was to tell it like it is, and was to describe what was really going on, and not pretend that there was some other reason for doing something when, in fact, we knew that race had played such a role in what happened.
Lieutenant Governor, what is your reaction to the Supreme Court ruling this morning banning capital punishment?
I think it comes as a surprise, maybe to most of the people in this country. It's shocking. It's a dark day in this country. What we've, through this decision by the court, we have licensed murder, rape, and anarchy. I think we're reverting to the jungle life.
Growing more concerned with each release, the governor called for a moratorium on the death penalty. He then convened a Blue Ribbon Commission to study Illinois' criminal justice system.
I was asked to serve on the commission, and of course I was delighted to do it. And I really had not had the chance to stand back and look at this system as a whole. And it was useful for me just to begin asking myself, how do I really feel about this issue, the gravest issue in the criminal law?
In choosing that commission, he really went out of his way to find a group of folks who really were very much across the board on the issue, and not necessarily people who were in the middle of the debate.
A very elite group, in my mind, of smart, dedicated citizens, prosecutors, defense lawyers, former elected officials and business people.
He didn't come to us. He didn't come to other activists. He went to folks who were more or less somewhat centrist.
Within my moral universe, which is a moral universe that I think in some regards resembles that of many other Americans, I don't call executing John Wayne Gacy immoral. Gacy had killed 33 young men. It's just punishment for what he did. But the real question is, can we construct a capital system that only executes John Wayne Gacy without also executing the innocent or the undeserving? For me, the 2 years became a long-term education in understanding why the answer to that question is no.
For people that aren't intimately familiar with what happened to me, in April of 1993, two members of the Wisconsin Outlaws motorcycle gang came up to my father's motorcycle shop explicitly to rob and murder my parents. I found their bodies the next day. I was arrested by police within 3 hours illegally, it was determined later by the courts, held against my will. After an 18-hour interrogation, three policemen conspired and concocted a confession which I never uttered. I did not confess to the crime. The jury deliberated less than 3 hours before finding me guilty. I was subsequently sentenced to die by the judge. The ironies and coincidences are just staggering. You know, I'm not going to try and bring God into this. It's way too complicated, and I don't want to blame a lot of this on God. And then he works in mysterious ways, for sure. But Larry Marshall and 60 of his students took it upon themselves to investigate my case, my wrongful conviction, They got my conviction overturned by the appellate court in 1996, and I was freed 9 months later.
Ryan didn't have any confidence in the system, and I don't think anybody else had a lot of confidence in it either. And the idea of executing an innocent person all of a sudden was very, very real.
And that's why in the closing days of my administration, we're going to continue to work on this issue. The petitions are requesting that sentences of death be commuted to life without parole. We're reviewing each one of these cases to see if their trials were fair or if there is evidence that was ignored. And once I get these reports, I'll do what I think is right at that time.
Look at all the work that we've done, even on one death case, you know, when you represent one client. And here we had 167, 170, whatever the number was, death cases that were going to be decided in the next 6 months. And I and several other people made the decision that this was it. I mean, if the center got destroyed financially because of what we had to do on this, you know, there were worse reasons for that to happen. That this was one of those rare moments where you basically just jettison everything and say, this is a campaign, a narrow window that we're going to put all of our energy into.
The Prisoner Review Board is meeting an extraordinary session for the purpose of conducting executive clemency hearings under the authority of Chapter 730 of the Illinois Statutes. The Governor is empowered to grant or to deny clemency under any terms as he sees fit. This board will make confidential recommendations to the Governor after considering your testimony and your documentary evidence.
Todos aquellos que van a participar en este procedimiento, que van a testificar, por favor, pónganse de pie. Juran que van a decir la verdad, solemnemente que van a decir la verdad, la pura verdad, con la ayuda de Dios.
Sí.
Pueden sentarse, por favor.
Counsel, please proceed for the petitioner.
I'm Alan Andrews from the Office of the State Appellate Defender, Supreme Court Unit in Springfield, and I'm here on behalf of Gabriel Salache, and I appreciate this opportunity to present his side of the story as to why he should be recommended for clemency, because he did not commit this crime.
Mi nombre es Gabriel Solache. Yo soy mexicano, nací en Michoacán, México. Quería salir adelante. En mi país no existe posibilidades para nosotros, los de la clase baja, media baja. Tuve que viajar aquí a los Estados Unidos para salir adelante, ¿no? Siempre estuve trabajando, nunca anduve en las calles haciendo algo, robando o algo así, o vendiendo drogas. Siempre me enseñaron a trabajar y a ganar el dinero, no a ganar el dinero fácil.
Yo quisiera que se miraran un poquito para el lado de nosotros, el dolor.
I wish they could look our way a little bit, the pain.
Y no de esos asesinos.
And not those murderers.
Yo tengo cinco hijos.
I have five children.
Yo he visto por esos otros dos.
And I've been taking care of the other two. And thank you very much. Gracias, señor. Gracias por venir.
Gabriel Salache was detained for over 40 hours while he was interrogated by the police. He was handcuffed to the wall by one hand for long periods of time in these various holding rooms in the police station. There's little food. Gabriel Salache testified that over 40 hours he was given a sandwich. This was a high-profile case. Two parents murdered, two children missing for days. And in a high-profile case like that, where the crime is ongoing, there's a lot of pressure to solve the crime. And a lot of pressure to solve the crime is the type of thing that would prompt a police officer to take liberties that perhaps he would not take in other cases. Gabriel Salache testified at his hearing that he finally confessed because I couldn't stand the beating anymore. People do falsely confess to crimes that they never committed. The short-term relief that an individual believes that he will receive by confessing to a crime that he does not commit is perceived to outweigh the potential harm to him in the future.
Ellos me hicieron culpable. Yo no cometí ningún crimen. Él me golpeó varias veces. Mi oído me lo afectó, el lado izquierdo. No escucho nada, nomás un zumbido es lo que tengo. Es aquí. Es una... Porque también ellos todo estaba en inglés, o sea que yo no sabía nada.
I'm an assistant state attorney. I, along with my partner, Arthur Hill, first assistant state attorney, represent Richard Devine, and we stand in strenuous opposition to this petition for clemency. What is important here is that when defendants are faced with brutal facts, certain things come about, either all of a sudden mental retardation, all of a sudden insanity, or if those are not available to you, then someone else must have done it, and I must have been beaten. He's the murderer.
And finally, I would point out just briefly that Detective Guevara was both the interrogator and the translator in this case. There is no way for us to know how accurate the confession is because Detective Guevara is the only person who heard and understood what Gabriel Solace told him.
Mr. Solace is asked to sign that statement.
Yes.
The statement is in English. How does he know what that statement contains?
Detective Guevara said that he read it back to him.
So it was only Detective Guevara at every point in this?
At every single point. I can't promise you he's innocent, but he has always denied it. He did not plead guilty. There is no evidence. And it would behoove this board to recommend clemency so that Mr. Solace is not working under a ticking clock as he tries to prove his innocence, because he has to prove it now because he's been convicted.
There's no issue of prosecutorial misconduct. There is no issue of ineffectiveness of counsel. There is nothing here. What are they hanging their hat on? Detective Guevara, the beater. There's the pictures. Detective Guevara did not beat Gabriel Solace. Gabriel Solace told the truth about his participation in the murders. The Soto children, the Soto family, asked this court, asked this board to deny clemency to Gabriel Solace.
Thank you, Ms. Rosales.
Tenía miedo y tengo miedo todavía ahora porque es la prisión, ¿no? O sea, es prisión, no es vida, o sea, nomás son días que no cuentan. O sea que siempre es el mismo día, no hay ninguna diferencia.
The death penalty, according to the Supreme Court, is not supposed to be applied to every first-degree murder. There have to be select criteria, the so-called worst of the worst.
One from Evan Building back to Upper.
Those are the cases that are most liable to incredible emotion in the judgments that are made about them. And that's true for cops, that's true for prosecutors, judges, juries, even defense lawyers. So it's much easier to convict an innocent person of a heinous crime than of stealing a treasury check.
You do not measure the civility of a society by how you treat the wealthy, how you treat the affluent, how you treat the well-liked. You get no points for treating those people fairly or responsibly. You don't measure your commitment to the law by the way you apply it to those who have resources, to those who you are always rooting for. You don't measure the integrity of society by how it deals with the people who have power. You measure the integrity of society, the civility of society, your commitment to the law, by how you treat the people who are hated.
Locked down 24 hours a day. You may come out occasionally to take a shower. You may go to the chapel for church periodically. And I remember the time sometimes when the sun would be going down in the afternoon, I would try to crouch up in the corner just to try to get just a little sun. And one of the amazing things is when you go out, the depth chair was right there, and they would have the curtains open. And as we are trying to enjoy the little sunshine or whatever, you look over, you're looking right at the depth chair, you know, so. This is it. You got to cut it all off, man. Cut quick. Knocking a day of one who's going astray. I used to be a very optimistic before I went to prison. I wanted to enjoy life, I wanted to really get involved in the things. I wanted to know different people, go different places. And I became very pessimistic about doing anything. And I'm so clouded in my mind now with darkness until I can't really find out exactly what it is or where it is, where I want to go. It's almost like I have this sadness about me all the time, you know. And that's something that I don't like. Because I used to, you know, I don't feel good like I want to feel. I don't feel that joy. And I think that's missing.
I remember Mom going to the door and answering it and asking, is Dave home? And she said, no. I got my dad's flashlight and ran out the back door to go to my grandmother's house to let him know that, hey, the cops are looking for you.
It was just like the earth stood still with me, you know. Because what they had accused him of, I knew he hadn't done it. I still don't know today why he stayed in there so long. You know, after they proved that they didn't do the crime, I still don't know today why.
Growing up black in this state, you know, you really didn't have a chance when it came to a crime. You know, they say that justice is blind, but justice really isn't blind. I see what talent, you know, God had given this man and how this justice system destroyed all of that. You know, often telling you, man, I love you, and you have so much talent. You have so much to give this world. You know, don't let what they did to you destroy you. And it's just so hard to reach beyond that pain and that hurt that he must have gone through there.
I always wanted to just get away, just get out and have millions of dollars. Yeah, that was one of my dreams. To be the best at whatever it was. And now I'm the best alcoholic around here. Trying to forget what I've gone through, trying to overcome the mental blockers that I've put up, trying to reach that wall. Sometimes it's a little bit higher than I can reach. I managed somehow. I'll eventually do it.
Asked his commission to determine what reforms, if any, would render the Illinois capital justice system fair, just, and accurate.
They basically said the whole system had to be overhauled, and even then, you still couldn't guarantee that an innocent person wouldn't be executed.
And, you know, and frankly, the legislature, I think they just tanked on this. They just whiffed. And it was during an election, you know, right before an election when these came out.
all legislators want to be able to in their next election say, I'm tough on crime, I've done this, I've done that, we're going to send these people to jail forever, or we're going to, you know, this, we create new crimes. And we have really, I think, gone, and I was a prosecutor for 9 years, so I'm pro-law enforcement, I'm pro-police officer, pro-prosecutor, but we have as a General Assembly probably been geared more in public policy and how our next elections are going to look.
They didn't do anything. They had that entire time. They didn't do anything.
I mean, as one of them explained it to me, the only way you can get into trouble is by doing something. That's what they thought. What are they going to do, limit the death penalty? The public likes the death penalty. You know, 70% of people in Illinois say they believe in it. So they figured, do nothing.
I got to death row when I was 19, so 22 now. You know, get homesick, you know, I mean, you know, and I've never even been this far down south in Illinois before, so, you know, I mean, it's just hard not really having anybody, you know. I don't really know anybody here, you know. I'm on my own, basically. Well, they're gonna kill me, so why should I be scared, you know, about other inmates, you know? So it was scary, you know.
The next case will be Robert Jones, Cook County.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. We welcome statements from victims and families of victims. We ask if there are a number who have interest in this case to select one or two from them to make the oral presentation. We would ask all those who oppose this petition to please stand at this time. Is the petitioner ready? Please proceed.
What is justice? These families here, to several families out there, perhaps justice would be 5 minutes alone with Robbie Jones. To the Jones family, it would be something less. Because of this disparity, our society has created the criminal justice system to prevent vigilantism as well as to ensure punishment of those convicted of crimes.
It has been more than 3 years since the beginning of our nightmare. Jones invaded Darren and Rhonda's home. He shot them both in the head. The evidence indicated that Darren was shot first while they were both asleep. Rhonda, startled by the sound, sat up in bed and was shot. A second shot to her face ended her life. The defendant was not satisfied with just killing them. He took the time to drag Rhonda off the bed and rape her post-mortem. Robert Jones devastated our happy lives. These murders affected not only our families, but our rural community as well. It would be a grave insult to our family if Governor Ryan were to grant Jones clemency.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am, if you'll please first introduce yourself and speak, tell us what you'd like us to hear today.
Thank you for allowing me to do this, first of all. It's very, very difficult all the way around. I am Robbie Jones's mother, and I am here today to plead for his life. His biological father was an abusive and dangerous man. He witnessed daily beatings against me. By the time my new husband, Paul, had come into our lives, Robbie was 5, and we know now the damage had been done. Our hearts will forever bleed for the loss of Darren Ulrich and Rhonda Worm. We've known their families between the two of us all of our lives. So why add to the tragedy of taking yet another young life? It will prove nothing. We also lost a son that night. We're all victims here.
It is difficult, and maybe it's impossible for the people who've suffered the loss to forgive, but it was important that you talk today. Thank you, Mrs. Jones.
I'm Rod Worm. I'm Rhonda's dad. She was my daughter. please have some patience with me because I'm really nervous. And if I may, I'd say something to Kelly.
Please go right ahead.
I can't forget Robbie.
No, I don't. I'm not asking for forgiveness.
I can't forgive him at all. He committed to crime with my daughter.
I'm not asking for forgiveness. I can't even do it myself, Rod.
I want him executed. I can't help it.
I'm
sorry.
But I understand.
It's the way it is.
I understand. I do, Rod. I do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Worm.
Thank you.
We've heard from the families today. We've heard from the families for the last 2 weeks. The cry is the same. Give us justice. We want justice. Is not justice capture and conviction? Is not justice a lifetime behind bars? Is not justice a cold, slow, lonely death, not by the needle, but by the key?
You know, like when it gets, when it's real quiet at night, like, you know, midnight, 1 a.m, sometimes you can't sleep and you just kind of sit back and stare at the ceiling and think back, you know, remember everything.
For a warden, you know, you can just look out on the prison yard and look at the humanity in there and be reminded of all the pain and victimization that those people have caused. If you work in prisons for a living, your views frequently are shaped by your experiences. And over a period of time, I reluctantly acknowledged that the death penalty might be a necessary evil for, quote, those few worst people. I realized somewhere in my career I'm going to face this rather ugly duty. I was naive enough to think that Vietnam would prepare me for executing somebody.
How you doing, Edward? Okay?
Yep.
All right?
Yep, come on.
Man, come on in, let me talk at you for a minute.
All of the things that you have to do in preparation. You have to sit down with a guy and say, what do you want for supper Wednesday night? The last time around.
Did you eat any of that shrimp they brought you this evening? You said you've never tried shrimp before, is that right?
Picking staff who will be on the execution team. Think for a minute about how surreal it is to have to find prison employees who volunteer and having to discern that they're not too eager as volunteers. My decision as to who I designated to actually mix the chemicals has had long-standing repercussions for that individual.
It's going to be rough for us also, you know, because some of us been here 6 years, 10 and more, and we got close to him, you know, which we shouldn't be. But you can't help it when you're working around some guys like this.
I'm beginning to understand, and probably will understand even better after the execution, why, strangely enough, over the years, at least in this country, a number of wardens who have performed large numbers of executions in the 30s and 40s when they were prevalent. Nonetheless, despite the fact they did the jobs, and pulled the switches or pushed the buttons many, many times, were nonetheless very strong opponents of capital punishment.
Did he have any last statements?
Yes, he did. He stated he's thankful that the process was coming to a close for himself and his family. And stated that he was not guilty.
Americans don't have the right to ask their prison officials to execute innocent people, even if it's by honest mistake. And the problem, of course, that we've learned from Governor Ryan is that in Illinois, innocent people didn't always go to death row because of honest mistakes or human error. Some of them went to death row in Illinois because evidence was withheld on discovery. In other cases, evidence was manufactured. Law enforcement, even prosecutors, lied. And that's the kind of stuff the public doesn't see.
Shortly after he got into office, Governor Ryan was faced with an execution of his own. Andrew Corcoralis, who was sort of the poster boy for why you should have the death penalty, was a really horrible, brutal torture, rape, murder.
I had to decide if convicted murderer Anthony Corcoralis should live or he should die. I'm a pharmacist who had the good fortune to be elected governor of this great state. Now, suddenly, I shouldered the burden of making the decisions about life or death. Instead of filling orders for life-saving drugs, my job now was to decide who was going to be injected with lethal drugs to kill them. Should they live or should they die? Governors have the last word.
The way he always described it was that once it's your job, everything changes. Actually having to do it was, I think, was very hard for him.
I remember covering Ryan that night and covering that story that night, and he freaked out. I mean, he just completely freaked out, and he had people going in and out of his office all night long, making the argument either for going ahead and approving the execution or staying the execution. And he kept on changing his mind all night long up to midnight.
I know the burden, and I know what it feels like to be responsible for a man to be executed, and it's not pleasant.
Everybody who wants to run for public office in America, from the White House to dog catcher, has to be tough on crime, and they have to be for the death penalty, or they're not going to get elected.
There's no better example of that than Bill Clinton in 1992, when presented with an incredibly compelling case involving a mentally ill man who had no idea he was about to be executed, who told his lawyers to save his dessert for him after he had his last meal before he went to be executed, because he would eat it after the execution. Someone who even members of the victim's family had recognized should not be executed was nonetheless executed, because in the midst of this political campaign for the presidency of the United States, it would be impossible to do something like suggest a weakness on the crime issue.
This is a nation of laws, and as Abraham Lincoln has said, no one is above the law, no one is below the law, and we're going to enforce the law, and Americans should remember that if we're going to have law.
But Richard Nixon was the first politician on the national level who discovered crime as a real workable issue. I mean, up until then, crime had always been considered a local problem.
Today, President Nixon, with J. Edgar Hoover at his side, signed the sweeping anti-crime bill he had asked of the Congress.
Gentlemen, I give you the tools, you do the job.
We will.
I think what Nixon did was picked up on the backlash, and it was a feeling of, you know, the country is really out of control, so we've got to be tough. And, of course, the ultimate way to show you're tough is the death penalty.
Some people are inferior. And because it no longer became politically acceptable to talk in just blatantly race terms for that debate and that dynamic, it became necessary to use new terms. And felons, criminals became the new categories. But I think the presumption about who we were talking about didn't change so much. We were still talking about the poor and people of color.
I think if someone had said in 1972, we have gone through in the 1960s a civil rights movement, We've gone from a society that was segregated to a society that's now trying to reconcile the history of slavery and the history of racial oppression. And in the kind of society that we want to be in the future, there's no place for capital punishment. As Dr. King said, capital punishment is society's ultimate statement that it will not forgive. I think if we had had that kind of leadership, I'm not sure that the American people wouldn't have followed. Unfortunately, the kind of leadership we had was that criminals were being freed on the streets and the whole country was about to go to hell in a handbasket because of crime, and we had to have these draconian punishments and so forth in order to protect the society.
Knew it would be back. We hoped that it would take longer than it did. You see, because it was back with a vengeance, you know, by the, mid-70s.
You know, give us a new try, the states had said to the court. You know, we know Furman was bad, our statutes were bad before Furman, but now we've done it. Now we've removed all the problems. And the Supreme Court, being basically a reactive institution, has to say, okay, fine. You know, we struck down the old mode, you have a new mode, we'll give it a try.
I think we realized that the death penalty, the door had been opened back up again, but I don't think we foresaw executions occurring again on a large scale. However, by 1977, Gary Gilmore comes along and he changes everything. Gilmore opened the floodgates. The mistake we made is that a lot of people thought that the Furman decision was the end, and it was just the beginning.
Are you still confident that the 458 prisoners on death row have had their legal rights protected in these life and death cases?
I'm absolutely confident that everybody has been put to death as two things. One, they're guilty of the crime charged. And secondly, they had full access to our courts, both state and federal. I will make sure every death penalty case that comes to my desk, so long as I'm the governor, I hope it's not that long, by the way, that I will make sure that the innocence and guilt are, that I weigh heavily the innocence and guilt of each person.
I've been asked if I'm haunted by it. No. What would you have had me do? On that hot night in July, after I gave the order for him to die, I watched him while I was thinking, what is my God going to ask of me? I think now I can respond that I had no malice in my heart. And I think I did the best I knew how, you know.
I think I'm thinking that eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, that some of that is in there. I think some of that is embedded in the American psyche, that if a person is guilty of taking a life, you know, then we should assume that she or he is prepared to give theirs up.
The question is not whether he committed these crimes. He is probably as guilty, to my mind, as if you and I witnessed the crime firsthand. The question is whether he should live or die. And if you have any reservation, now's the time to say it.
I stand here today as emphatic about his sentence as I did 12 years ago when I asked the jury for it. He deserves the death penalty.
Thank you. If there are more questions, thank you all very much.
Thank you again for your time, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir. We'll now hear the next case.
He deserves to die for this crime.
This is a family that was in court for 5 years, two rows deep, every single continuance. And I know they want to ask you for the same thing we asked for, and that is justice, and that is the death penalty.
Thank you, Ms. Worthy.
Personality disorders, antisocial, etc., ability to control emotions. These are just more euphemisms for someone with a violent criminal nature. That does not mean that they're crazy. It just means that they're what criminals are, people that don't want to take responsibility for their horrific actions.
There is nothing wrong with him other than he's just an evil individual. The only appropriate sentence is the sentence of death. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Questions?
You've been a prosecutor. When you get a case, a death penalty case, you've lived with it for years. You know, you maybe were at the crime scene. You saw what happened. You knew all about the case. You knew everything. You've been dealing with victims. You've been dealing with their families. You've been dealing with law enforcement officers. You've been dealing with the trial that maybe went on for a couple months. You've lived with this case, and you knew, or at least you believed, and oftentimes knew that this person was guilty. There was no question in your mind as a prosecutor. There was no question in your mind as a law enforcement officer. There was no question in your mind as a jury because they were convicted. You had gone through the appeal process. You had success in the appeal process, and you felt like there was some closure. And then all of a sudden, along comes the governor and says, "All right, that closure's no longer there. We're going to open it up." It is a real sense of outrage from prosecutors and from the law enforcement officers, and certainly the families that were involved in this.
Capital trials are highly emotional affairs. People do not think rationally and logically. The prosecutors are prosecuting these cases as though seeking the death penalty and obtaining it was an Olympic competitor sport.
The fact of the matter is that the crime is committed against the community as a whole. Community values generally end up prevailing. And to a great extent, prosecutors trot out the victims when they want to justify the death sentences. And they ignore them when they don't want to impose a death sentence.
Here's this family. What can you do for them? They're in such pain. And you draw a link between them. And suddenly I think the jury feels we have to do something. And, you know, what can we do? We can
kill
and sentence somebody to death.
Right.
It's an exploitation of victims to kind of create a system where if you really loved your husband, you loved your child, you've got to get into the criminal courts and you've got to fight for the death penalty, because the death penalty becomes the blue ribbon of how much you really cared about your loved one, about how valuable their life was.
Ladies and gentlemen of this board, I ask you to deny his petition for clemency. The issues have been raised, the issues have been denied. Any other issues on other issues in the trial?
The intake person who examined him when he was brought into the jail doesn't know anything.
I guess I got you the question of whether, why is this a reason to commit a sentence in natural life?
If it was somebody I loved who was killed, I would want the severest sanction possible imposed, just as a statement of the value of that person's life to me. I understand it, but we don't resolve questions in the criminal law by asking how the victims feel, because we know how they feel. They feel full of rage, outrage. They want it not to have happened. I'm not criticizing anybody for what their emotional needs are, but does that make sense in a democracy where you're supposed to treat like cases alike, where you're going to have equality under the law, that, you know, it's one family's view of justice versus another? That's how you're going to decide who's living and dying?
We're here to ask that you can spare their father's life. He still plays a role. He writes them. He sends them birthday cards. He talks to them all the time how they should respect their elders who are good in school to do their best. They're both right now on the honor roll. I don't have any problems with them. I don't feel that it would be right to take their father's life, because it would be only... would only be punishing his children. And I just ask that you would spare his life for the sake of his children, if nothing else.
Okay.
I'm going to meet with the victim's family. How soon as we can get it worked out.
As much as he was affected by the victim's families at the clemency hearings, he was then affected by sort of prosecutors' refusal to sort of concede any points at all. He saw that as, wait a second, they still don't give any ground here, that there's a problem.
When there's been a horrible crime committed, there's tremendous pressure on the police and the prosecution to find somebody. Now, I'm not saying for 1 minute that people just go out and pick a person at random, but what happens is there'll be somebody that there's some evidence that suggests this might be the person. And they hone in on that person, they put the blinders on, and everything is aimed at trying to convict that person.
I just got out of prison. I just served 14 and a half years for murder, armed robbery murder, that I did commit. A guy I met in prison, we started hanging out. We started robbing drug houses. One day, Chicago police come way out there and pick me up.
I just want to give a brief history about Graylin Johnson. Out of the last 31 years of his life, he spent less than 1 year as a free man. He's either been in jail, on parole, on bond, or AWOL from the Army. He is an assassin. He's a professional killer. There's a reason for the death penalty, and Graylin Johnson is one of your poster childs that I'm sure you've heard of throughout these weeks.
They told me that I was being arrested for a parole violation. And they took me to Chicago. And now they tried to get me to talk to him. I kept saying, I want to call my attorney. I want to call my attorney. So they tortured me into signing a false confession.
The police take him to a bathroom, Chicago police, hang him out the window by his handcuffs and by the cuffs on his feet and his arms, and say, see that car down there? You sure you don't recognize that car? You're going to be awful close to it if you don't say you recognize that car.
These guys knew what they were doing. Before they started, they told me and said, well, nigga, they ain't going to believe you, even if you tell them. We in advance. I had no idea what he was talking about, you know, until it started. And I'm just thinking that, well, you know, I've been beat up by the police, but I didn't know it was going to go to this extent. I didn't know what they were up to, so, yeah.
He cannot show anything at all. Here's a picture of him when he was brought into the Cook County Jail. There is no marks upon this defendant whatsoever. That's what the trial judge was able to see. That's what the jurors were able to see. And that's why the Supreme Court rejected all the defendant's claims.
The police department learned that leaving physical marks on people gets you into big trouble. And the purpose of bagging somebody's head and hitting them on the head with a phone book or with an object or while they're bagged is to not leave marks. It causes a concussion. It causes your brain to buzz, but it doesn't leave physical marks on you, and that's the purpose of it. That's the purpose of the torture.
You know, in prison, it's a sense of false pride or dignity, as you want to call it. You got all these so-called rough guys around you, and to tell them that somebody beat you to make you admit to something that you didn't do, guys don't want to admit that, so they keep it to themselves. They used to ask me, what's wrong with you? I'm thinking about how they did, man, that police station, and then how the prosecutors lay here and did what they did. And so guy got to talk, yeah, well, you know, I was at that station, you know, Officer So, you know, Officer So and So, yeah, well, you know, he did this to me. So guys got to find out, hey, it's a bunch that's been down here a while, been tortured. So when I went back to court, I get a letter. We organized the death row 10.
Death row 10 or 12 or whatever number you want to put on them are a group of inmates who allege that in the 70s and 80s they were tortured to confess. Police used plastic typewriter bags. to try to suffocate people, used electric prods to shock them.
A Russian roulette was being played. People were being lifted up by handcuffs in tremendously painful situations. People were being punched, but were being punched with telephone books over them so that it would dissipate the range of the wound and not leave any bruises. These were well-known devices that have been documented. They were used in Vietnam as interrogation techniques.
Push people against radiators to burn them, hit them, put guns in their mouths. Sort of third world torture on Chicago's south side.
The fact that he's sentenced to death with a jury not being told, or them not at least being able to consider the information that indicates that he was tortured, that this alleged confession was tortured out of him, is a serious problem with the criminal justice system.
We'll now recess for 5 minutes to clear the room, and then we'll have the executive session deliberations.
The media now had the prosecutors telling their story, the victims' families telling their story, and that's all the media wanted to talk about. And the governor was clearly being affected. And you couldn't help but be affected. I mean, I sat in that room and I saw it cry like a baby when you listened to these stories. How could you not? I mean, this was awful, awful stuff.
I would guess that at this point that I have pretty much ruled out blanket commutation based on the hearings and the information that I've gathered so far.
I don't expect him to let everybody on Illinois' death row be commutated to life. But the very fact that he's willing to look at him, and the fact that he's thrown the doors open and allowed the media in, says that this is a guy who thinks that what's almost more important than what we do ultimately is the way we do it. And I think he wants to be as fair as possible. And I think he's affected by the human condition.
I think he's...
He's just an old-time Paul, really.
He's an old-time politician, you know, Illinois-style politician.
There's something kind of small-townish about him. I mean, he was from a pretty small town, Kankakee. And, but he was very astute, and he was most interested in politics, and he was pretty astute politically.
I mean, he's a from-the-ground-up kind of a politician. So a lot of it is...
He's a fool, but he's not right. Like a sharp ear.
And so I think it's a lot of it is just sort of... sort of basic, you know, local politics. And, you know, I think he probably comes to sort of moral issues the way anybody would, you know, with not a lot of background and just grappling them with them as best he can.
I think in this society where crime policy is so incident-driven, the stories of individuals is always compelling. It's always a central part of how laws change, how policies change, and those narratives are incredibly important when you see folks who survived the death penalty and survived it in a way that contradicts the notion that their life had no value, had no meaning, that they were beyond hope. I think that's a very powerful witness against why it would have been so unjust, so tragic had they been killed.
Based upon the way that the legal system had been going in my individual case, I'd have been dead if not for the affirming decision. I sincerely believe that. I mean, my childhood was a constant questioning, you know, a pursuit of answers to things that just did not make sense to me. I see these guys coming down Fulton Street, and they got these black tans and black leather coats, and I went up and I asked this person, I said, "Yo, what's this?" "It's just the Black Panther Party." I'd seen them on the TV before, but I had never seen them in New York. I was surprised. I was utterly and completely surprised. I really thought they were like a paramilitary group. There was no coverage back then about the breakfast programs, the clothing programs. They were talking about the issues of poverty and discrimination, helping the African-American child to compete. The whole 60s, I was just a part of it. I was, you know, you could see the movement. You could see what the past was. You could see what the present had to offer, you know, and what the future promised. You know, it was there. But then, in about 69, heroin addiction was making major inroads. I mean, I could see, you know, our communities just saturated with drugs. I joined this group where you go in, you destroy the drugs, whatever method you use to destroy it, you destroy it. We were doing surveillance. The next thing I know, I hear gunshots. While I did not pull a trigger, you know, I was involved in a historical circumstance that cost two human lives. And I mean, that's a burden I carry.
We have used the death penalty to propagate this idea that individuals can be crimes, that you are just a crime. And therefore, we can punish your crime by destroying you completely.
I was released in 1991. Been on parole for 12 years. I have 9 o'clock curfew. I must submit to periodic drug testing. Last year, I had two jobs. I was working for the Innocence Project, and I was working for this law firm. I'll never be the same. I never wanted to be even remotely related to taking a human life. Every opportunity I get, you know, I try to tell my story.
All that's needed in the death penalty debate in America is education. And ultimately, we're building toward a result that will stand on the shoulders of Furman, will stand on the shoulders of what so many people are doing around the country right now, but we'll all be able to stand proud of that day, and we shouldn't lose hope just because it doesn't happen overnight.
We went through hearings recently where we saw prosecutors come over and over and over. This one, I know that guy's guilty, they told us. And this one, well, that guy certainly deserves to die. And that woman is clearly guilty. And of course, the question is, wait a minute, didn't you say that about him? Didn't you say that about him? Didn't you say that about him? Were you only kind of sort of sure that they were guilty when you were ready to put them to death?
Has your study of the individual cases so far convinced you that a blanket commutation is not the way to go?
Well, I'm not sure about anything at this point. I said to the victims' families the other day when I talked to them that it certainly was on the back burner.
Do you have any deadline yourself, personally, where you would make a decision on this subject?
Certainly before January the 13th at noon.
But no, not before? Do you know what
I don't know
say?
What I'm going to do. It's the reports that you folks come out with on a daily basis about what I'm doing and what I'm not doing. So, I mean, all of this stuff probably has an impact.
Everything has been really emotional, though, you know, talking to the family.
Life and death is emotional.
How are we going to persuade this governor, this jury of one, to do what we believed was so important?
We each have the power, the responsibility to do everything we can to implore the governor to heed the message that commutation is indeed the solution. We're going to be doing a walk of wrongly convicted men, the walkers, who will leave Stateville carrying a message for the governor. And after a mile or two, he'll be met by another wrongly convicted, and the letter will be presented to Governor Ryan, and that letter will be born of their experiences and say what they have learned, what they went through.
December 2002, to the Honorable Governor
George R. Ryan, Governor of Illinois. We are the exonerated who have each walked in the valley of the shadow of death. The courts and the public were certain that we were guilty and that we had forfeited our rights to live. Only through miracles did the truth emerge. That truth provided we were victims of wrongful convictions.
The 37-mile walk from Stateville Correctional Center ended at the Thompson Center with former death row inmate Anthony Porter handing Governor Ryan's spokesperson a letter.
Well, I brought this down here so you can hand it to Governor Ryan. I would like to hand it to him in person. I'll just commute for all people on death row.
Everybody not getting justice. It's two sides to justice. It's the rich man justice and the poor man justice.
What does the death penalty accomplish? It doesn't deter. That evidence is lacking. It doesn't save money. So what is it that it does? It's a symbol. It's a moral statement. You know, ultimate punishment for ultimate evil. I think values are really important. I think the value system of Americans is really important. But you have to recognize, if you're using the death penalty for a symbolic purpose, to make a moral statement, that it makes a great deal of difference if you're executing the wrong people. Because you're not sending a clear moral message. You're not saying ultimate punishment for ultimate evil. You're saying ultimate punishment for ultimate evil sometimes, maybe not so evil, and maybe he didn't even do it.
Governor Ryan fully understood that innocence could not carry the day on the commutations, that there were several dozen, if not more, people who were openly admitting their guilt, who had admitted their guilt throughout, that there were, you know, just as conclusive evidence as one can imagine. So if this was all about innocence, factual innocence, you know, there would really be no justification of those cases. But the governor also came to understand, if you could open people's minds through the prism of innocence, you begin to erode their views and they become educated about other facets of the issue. Now they start to worry about race. Now they start to worry about bad lawyering. Now they start to worry about poverty and the effect of class and all the myriad other factors that make this so arbitrary, so unfair, so much like the strike of lightning that the Supreme Court condemned in Furman.
We just didn't really know where he was going, or you'd hear one little thing and you'd think he was going this direction, and then the next day you'd hear something else, like he had met with this group. He's going to meet with the family members of the victims and on Sunday, and so he might change his mind again. And
we have one more weekend where we're putting on a push before Christmas, before the governor goes into his soul and his moral being and decides what he's going to do here. We worked for what was right, we worked for what was just, and if it doesn't happen, and it might not, then we will still be able to look at ourselves in the mirror and say, it's not an easy road, but we're still many, many steps closer than we were before we started. So thank you all, and God bless.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rennie Cushing, and I'm the Executive Director of Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. We're a national organization of individuals who've lost a loved one to homicide and who oppose the death penalty. There's a paradigm in this country that presumes that everybody who's had someone murdered wants the death penalty and that they need it for something called closure. We don't fit that paradigm. And the folks who will speak today know the pain of the funeral parlor. They know the emptiness of the graveyard, but they also know that there's a better alternative than a ritual killing.
My name is Bob Curley. On October 1st, 1997, my 10-year-old son Jeffrey was kidnapped and murdered by two pedophiles. And I am opposed to the death penalty.
I'm here today because my only daughter Julie was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing, April 19th, 1995. At 7 a.m. on a Monday morning, We took Tim McVeigh from his cage, and we killed him. And there was nothing in taking him from his cage to kill him that brought me any peace or any feel good.
My name is Mamie Till Mobley. My son, Emmett Till, was brutally murdered and lynched 47 years ago. I have no room in my heart for vengeance. I am against the death penalty because that would be something else I would have to live with.
My name is Ross Byrd. My father was killed in 1998 by three white men, and I oppose the death penalty.
My name is Bill Jenkins. My son William was shot and killed on his second day of work at a fast food restaurant 5 years ago. He was 16 years old. And I do not want the death penalty.
My name is Jean Bishop, and my younger sister Nancy and her husband Richard and their unborn baby were murdered in 1990, and I oppose the death penalty.
And I remember a couple of things that we talked about. I made the point that if he didn't do this, then I predicted and that this was something that would haunt him, that every time that someone was executed, he would have to live with the fact that he had had in his power to do this and had it.
To many, it looked like the Furman decision meant the end of the death penalty in the United States. This was not the case. Today, about 2.5 days before my term ends as governor, I stand before you to explain my frustrations and deep concerns about both the administration and the penalty of death. I'm commuting the sentence of all death row inmates, 167 of them. This is blanket commutation. And I said earlier that I promised the people of Illinois at some point that I wouldn't use it. At some point it was on the front burner. At some point it was on the back burner. But I always said it was an option that I may use and exercise, never really believing, as long ago as a week or 10 days, that I would blanket commute these sentences. I didn't believe I would do it myself. But I realize that my decision will draw ridicule and scorn and anger from many who oppose this decision. And they'll say that I'm usurping the decisions of judges and juries and state legislators. But as I have said, the people of our state have invested in me the power to act in the interest of justice. It's the only place in the Constitution done that way. And even if the exercise of my power becomes my burden, I'll bear it.
So I guess that in the days ahead, and I'm going to pray that we can open our hearts and provide something for victims' families other than the hope of revenge. You know, Abraham Lincoln was a hell of a guy. He took this state through some of the toughest, this country through the toughest times and the toughest part of our history we've ever known. And so I like to quote him a lot. He was always criticized. The press was always on him. That sounds familiar. His party was after him all the time. His cabinet was after him. He couldn't do anything right. But he always came up with the right solutions to tough problems. And he said once, I have always found that mercy bears richer fruits than strict justice. I can only hope, with God's help, that will be so. God bless all of you. Work hard for the program. Thank you.
In Illinois, we happen to have had a community of lawyers, activists, journalists who studied this very intently and got very lucky and were able to uncover a lot of cases. But if you're going to tell me that we have more wrongful convictions in Illinois than they have in Texas, when we've had a better lawyering system than they've had in Texas, we've had more resources in Illinois than they had in Texas, no way in the world that we have a worse problem in Illinois than they have in Florida, or they have in Georgia, or they have in North Carolina. It just isn't the case. It just isn't the case. We've uncovered the problem in Illinois better than other places so far. But the problem is as deep, much deeper, I believe, in many of these other jurisdictions.
I think the system is racial, frankly. I think it's a racist system. And not by anybody's intent. It's just the way it's worked out. Because minorities are generally poor, can't afford the kind of help and counsel that they need. The government has all of the tools. They have prosecutors. They have an awesome amount of power. And, you know, when you think about it, when somebody's indicted, they hand them an indictment that says United States of America versus you, or the state of Illinois versus you. That's pretty awesome. That includes the state treasury and all the manpower you can muster. Pretty awesome powers. And in a lot of cases, it's abused. All in the name of good government and tough on crime.
Once it mailed my letter, chaplain's waiting by the door. Now we cross that yard together, and they can't hurt me anymore. 'Cause I ain't going over yonder when no ghosts follow me. Another place beyond here where I be free, I believe I can get my radio to Johnson, Pibido can have my fame. Just send my Bible home, mama, call her every now and then. I suppose I got it coming. Can't ever pay enough, and all my ripping and running, I hurt everyone I loved. And the world to turn around without me, the sun will come up. That's what I believe.